Wednesday. We're in Hingley Village, Hingley Lake. And today we're going to have Pat Saylor talk. Present also are Connie and Agnes. It's all yours, Pat.
No, can I talk?
Talk. Say anything you want.
Okay. And then you're going to backtrack it?
Right.
Okay. Well, I was just talking about the bear thing. We used to have to watch all the food when the hunters were out and like cooking the bear ribs of fire or messing around and cooking ducks or boiling duck eggs or doing something always. And have you busy there all the time. And then couldn't go no place. Couldn't keep up when you're only 7 or 8 years old. You stuck in one place watching the camp and keeping things ready for when they came back, hot tea, and that kind of thing. Well, I'd like to just start out with some things my grandma told me about where she was from, or where she was born and grew up till she was the age of 12. At that time, she said she was born in the middle fork of the 40 Mile River, right below where Joseph Creek, down in that area there, with the caribou, 40 Mile caribou herd has their babies and calving grounds. And she had two older sisters, and one younger one, Lucy Luke, or next right under her. When they were 12, they went up the Middle Fork River, and a fork to the right, and then crossed over the mountains and dropped down into the head of Sam Crick country, and then went down to Samley, where her father, Grandpa Sam, and Belle Sam, and her mother, that's where they had their other two sisters, Eva and Lena, in Sam Creek. That's where they lived for quite a few years. And then from there they moved up here to Healy Lake, where they joined in with John Healy and Patty Healy and the rest of the band this way. That's when she wound up, her two older sisters, one of the older ones, it's Margaret Kerstadter. Her family stayed here pretty much in one spot for all these years. Her and Alice was the two kids from that. And they stayed, from those two sisters, the older ones that passed away, Margaret and Alice, their mother and their older sister, they passed away here. And that's when Grandma and then moved up this way. And I guess from that point, Margaret was moved up to Tanacross, where she was married to Jimmy Walder for a time. Was mistreated, and John Healy went up the river and grabbed her and took her back and brought her back home. From that point, they had quite a few good years where the caribou were high, cycled, and a lot came through. She said sometimes 4 days in a whole row there'd be nothing but caribou. You tell me a story about her and her son. She only had 9 shells, and she walked from the village, her firstborn. And he was like 9 years old, 8, 9, barely keeping him. He had 22. She shot 9 caribou and 9 bullets. And she was going to get the 22 to finish off a couple of them. And he'd been goofing around trying to shoot their antlers off this whole time. She wasn't paying attention to what he was doing. She said she got really mad at him. Went back and got to go get some more 22 shells. She said they used to have a real good time, especially around that time when there's so many caribou coming in. Our grandma taught us a lot of things that we didn't understand when we were small. She ended up in North Pole, where my mom married to my dadly sailor. A lot of times we slept with most of our clothes on. We didn't have PJs and stuff mostly, like most kids. And we're always ready to move all the time. Shoes close together by the door. It was an old habit from back when she came from when there was even last one, the skin tent. My mom was educated to the third or fourth grade, so that would make me and my brother and sister the first educated in our whole family. She talks about when she first seen some miners in there in the 40-mile country, and they had hair all over their face, long beards, and the first time they ever seen a donkey or horses, they didn't know what those were. Yeah. So a lot of things. There must have been some kind of a horrible shock, I was thinking. Now that I think back on it, it's like, for an example, if you took a knight in shining armor from back 500 years ago in England and slapped him in a Maserati and told him, here, drive. That's probably how she felt a lot of the time. And then it makes sense to me, but I understand her training of us. We ran around in the snow in the early in the morning, and I think Agnes remembers us getting tossed out the door when we were little, if not waking up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agnes used. Yeah. I remember used to warm our feet up when we came back. Yeah, we'd get tossed out the door and we'd have to run around the house. Mm-hmm. It taught us to wake up early and for times of war, they said when they were attacked or something, you would have to run without your shoes if you didn't have time to jump in your shoes. We made our little pack sacks and stashed them out in the woods with little crackers and dry meat and one pair of clothes and a little knife and stuff. And we thought it was a game when we were small, but I understand what it is now. She was making us ready in case the house burnt down or something happened and you had to get out of the house like right away. It was part of her training, what she was taught in case something bad happened. And everybody had their own caches, so it's not like if somebody got caught, they could tell on you. The only person who knew where the cache was you. And that served as survival, I understand it now. At the time, I didn't. And we were told that we didn't have a TV till we were age 12. And we didn't have regular friends except for family till the age of 12. Because we were being trained and we didn't need distractions. And she was teaching us. We didn't realize it because we thought all other kids were the same, probably. But now, the older I get, the more I see it as not the same. But I'm glad that we were trained the way we were trained so that we can make sense of what was happening. We spoke our language till the second grade, or we were told that we could learn our language on the weekends, which is not true. You can't learn English language just on the weekends. how are you supposed to learn all the native stuff, native language, in the weekends, which was false. I remember our first day of school, we went in, and we couldn't understand what the principal's telling us. So we'd understand some of it, and then we wouldn't. And he was hollering at us. And we ran away from him. He tried to chase us on top of the drift snow. We had moccasins, and we could outrun him, and we learned how to run on top of the snow. It was like lynx, or you spread your feet and move. We could move across stuff he couldn't. He couldn't keep up with us. So we went back, and Grandma came down really pissed. She went into the school, and she came, told us to wait outside and wait in one place. She used to put us in one place on our knees. This is part of our training too. And if we ran around, she even tied our legs, so we'd kneeling all the time. So we'd listen to her stories, and we'd sit in silence all day sometimes. And it was to teach us patience, and for hunting especially, or waiting for whatever it is, your opportunity. That was part of it. And it was disciplining us, disciplining our mind. Also, the steam bath, when we first went into that, we wanted to get out of there in a god-awful way, struggling. But they wouldn't let you out. They told you to be still, be quiet. And then they'd whip you with willows a lot of times. It loosens up your muscles, and the more the heat gets, it learns to take pain, a lot of pain. It disciplines your mind so that if you have rough times, that you can close off the pain. You could shut it off like a switch. You're not going to need a shot of painkiller. You wouldn't scream because you were taught not to make noise in case maybe if you were hurt or something bad happened. When Grandma was taught at war, you screamed out, you might give everybody away. So those parts of hurt we were taught to suppress. And even crying, that's part of it. It wasn't good to cry in front of people. I told you, no, you lost somebody. You went, the men, the warriors would find their time to go alone somewhere out in the woods where they would release that pain. Because that, you had to watch because others would take advantage of your weakness. That was part of it. But back to the, Grandma went down to the school, and we had to wait outside, back to the first day of school part. But we sat there waiting. All the lights in the school went out. And she was in the back room with the principal. I don't know what she did back there, but the entire room inside that room with the principal turned blue light. And she was talking in our language, but I think it was the old, really, really old language, because there's different. There's regular conversation language that you have if you're talking regular, like dealing deck, give me some tea, or I'll halt, and I'm going to go walking. But this was something different, something almost between animal and human in our language. And the whole place turned blue in there. And when she was done, he just heard him muttering and whatever, and not making much sense. But the lights came back on. She came back out of the office. And he came out shaking and pale white. And he never did bother us again. But we got to school on time, because we knew it was what to do then. But he never did bother us again. So I don't know what she did. I never asked. some parts he just better left unsaid, I guess. I'm sure whatever it was changed his mind. About parts of our train and about not having a television. That television, it strays your mind. Our television was storytelling. We could hear the same story over. Maybe we'd hear some of the same stories twice a day. And we'd sit there and listen and tell us stories. I like that one about Chinchutlchate. That's grandma's mom's Bell Sam's great uncle. That's about 150 years ago. That's where he comes from. That's where my grandma's sisters are born in the Sam Lake. Where that Chinchutlchate, they named that hill after him. He was a war chief of the whole Upper Tanana. I guess back Tetlin got wiped out. They were attacked by the Canadians from Kewaunee Lake. Came over the pass and over the hills and attacked and raided. And so they went to see Chinchutlchate to gather all the best warriors. He gathered all the warriors of the Upper Tanana. He climbed this tree, this leaning tree over all of them. And they were all underneath it. And he caught a squirrel that was running around. Anyway, at the top of that hill, he said, "Whatever warrior can grab this squirrel is coming with me." And he dropped a squirrel. And those who grabbed it when it was bouncing around between all the all these warriors down there, they had to be quick enough to grab arrows or dodge arrows. And this is his to find the best ones. And that one really wanted to go no matter what. He wouldn't take no for an answer. He was the only one that was killed in the battle once they went to Canada. But from Sam Lake to Kewaunee Lake, they made it in 5 days. That means they were cranking 75 miles, 100 miles a day. Steady moving, and back too, because it was just the pace. I understand that pace. And me and Ben were young. We moved through the country, way deep moving, just to explore new places. Way up the Healy, Upper George Lake, and Upper Sam Lake. They put something way above country, and we went 75 miles in one day and 45 the next day. I don't see any young kids doing that nowadays. Because what they have to understand why I'm explaining this is if they want to get through life or want to get have things done, they cannot do it by thinking that the easy way is the best way. You can't learn nothing so much from the easy way because you easy come, easy go. If you earned it hard, if you had to walk 75 miles or 100 miles to get something, 9 times out of 10 you're going to remember that because it was hard. And you had to go through so much to get it. So it's worth something. If you're going 50 to 100 miles an hour on a highway, you're not going to remember it. It's going to be worthless. Because you think you can get it all the time. There'll be a hard time. It's just the way life is. And if those who appreciate and work really hard and earn it, instead of trying to get it for nothing or steal it. See, if you have to do that, it gives you self-worth. It makes pride in yourself and pride in who you are. That is important because that may get you through when you think that oh, it can't get no worse, or I can't make it. How do you know you can't make it? Have you tried with everything you got? Have you tried every avenue? Sometimes we can't see the most simple things. The key to a door. I've run around with a pen in my hand, looking for a pen. And you can't tell me that ain't happened to every one of you in this world, because it has. That's the same kind of thing. That's the kind of discipline, the kind of people we come from, and the reasons being. It's like that story of Jinshel Jate. He trained his men on that hill. They used to run up at him, and he would be shooting at them. I mean, shooting to hit them. And they had either to bust the arrow in midair or catch it. And that's coming straight up the mountain, being shot at, straight down. It teaches, this kind of teaching makes you appreciate your life. Because you appreciate living. Because you earned the right to be there. And that's what I want the young people to remember. Even after I'm gone. Because when the hard time returns again, a depression, crash of the stock market or something, if you have that kind of knowledge, at least to know that it's in you, that you can always go back to it and discipline yourselves and be able to persevere, go through. Another thing that people do not understand is cross-cousin marriages in the Upper Tanana. From what I gathered from my grandmother, the uplands were the training, like Jinshel Jate, warriors. In the old days, mercenaries to the lower villages who had an easier life because of salmon runs. Salmon were huge in abundance and the food was lots of their villages. Had a huge amount of population compared to ours. Ours was a harder life and harder in the mountains and the highlands. And what could we give them that they didn't already have? What we could give them was our knowledge in hunting and war. Weaponry. Our best weapon was our mind. And the discipline. We were bred for almost 1,000 years from what I gather. They bred them down like you would a good dog team or you would a good strain of running horses. To the medicine people who could foresee the future, to the best and strongest warriors with the strongest legs, strongest arms, good best eyes. Were interbred with those who could see the future. They bred them to the fourth cousin because you couldn't get them any closer because I'm sure they've seen what happened when they bred too close. There was unbalance. Four was always a balance. Three would not do it. It'd be too close and your kids would be all messed up. The fourth cousin was as close as they'd tolerate. This was a strict code. They bred them like this so the offspring would not only be of the strongest blood and genes, of the sight and strength, but he could also foresee the future when he slept. So it made him even quicker, more advanced, so to speak. Almost genetic and engineering to become out with the perfect warrior. One that could endure anything that nature human had to offer. These were what they, Nuchaloya, where all the rest of the tribes came to gather. This is what the Upper Tanana had always brought to the table. When there was fights against Eskimos or the lower villages, if there was somebody making trouble, disrupting the peace, or messing something up, this is where you came to find your find either assassins or war chiefs, and the payment would be made big. With many blankets, many tan skins, wives, whatever they wanted. Copper was very treasured. Some of the blacksmiths, one of the last ones was my Grandpa Sam's brother, Nolfo, where at the point where I'm down at, he had a tent frame and stuff down there where he would hammer up in the valley there between the old village and my house. He had an old rock, just like a smith would have for hammering iron, and they would get trade to the copper, trade them paint. We had famous paint, red paint that came from this area, and other things. We traded with the copper to get their metal, which we pounded and folded until we had a triangular-like dagger that it went from the very tip to the very base. It was a triangle. And they pounded the curls on the end. The curls on both sides of that spear, and they used to tattoo on both cheeks of the warriors a spiral. Everybody wants to know what them spirals are. It's like the spirals on the knife hand, dagger handles, or the spear points. The spiral represents the caribou fences. Caribou fence had an opening with two corrals on both sides, which once the caribou went through the main opening, he spiraled to both sides. They'd shut one gate when it's full, take what they needed, then open up the other. And they'd have this continuous cycle. Also, it represented the Bertanana, the mother's side, because that meant the mother's womb. The fence, the opening of it, and the both sides is the same. That's what they meant by we take our mother as a clan side. The father and the warriors are meant to protect the family and the mother's side. This is why. They cannot get the okay to go to war without all the mothers getting together and consenting to it. You cannot just go out and do it. Just like in the Caucasian ways, they wouldn't think twice about doing it. They wouldn't be going home and asking their mothers. But in this case, the tribe, the mothers and the children will suffer because of war. That is the reason why it must make sense before it is done. It is not a senseless, foolish act. But these are the things that I've been taught, and I've went to look for myself many, many times. Just like our herd was a bigger population, and I heard it split in half, and half of it went across between Circle and Eagle, below the Charlie River, or above the Charlie River toward Eagle, and it went up and joined the Porcupine Caribou herd. And our old people, the old ones that were around and talked about it, Silas Solomon from Tanacross, came from Ketchumstuck country. They wanted to know what happened to the leaders and how come the caribou got all mixed up. Well, when they had the Taylor Highway and they started shooting off all the leaders. You can't shoot off all the leaders because they got their own leaders. Their scent is different from the rest in the whole herd. It's on the bottom of their feet, located between both toes. It's a scent gland. And maybe one out of a couple hundred will be born with that, and all the rest of them follow him or her. Now, if you shoot those off, the rest of the caribou get confused, and they start milling around. And they get confused, they don't know where to go or what to do. So once they shot off the herd, they shot off the herd leaders coming across the Taylor, you had all this milling about, confusion. Because once the leader died, that's where they was. They were stuck, panicking. So one of the leaders that were still around must have, they've got sense too, they ain't all stupid. They changed their route and went across and went up and joined the other caribou in the Porcupine region. Well, our people wanted to know, and Healy Lake being small is also scouts for the rest of the Upper Tanana to find out things for them about other tribes. Silas Solomon was one of those who could understand the Quechin language and the Upper Tanana language and the Copper language and the Canadian language. We sent people like that, like me, to find out things, to convey the other tribe's concern, or to make alliances in times of trouble. So I went north, and there was people in Circle that remembered my grandfather, Chief Healy and Silas Solomon, and them coming all the way to Circle to get tea and sugar from the steamboats and meet with Chief Roberts, the chief of the Quechins around Fort Yukon, and Venatine Arctic's chiefs coming down and meeting, because the caribou crossed the river below Circle, and then between Circle and Eagle, and made a rotating spiral through their country. And their people helped hunt our herd just as well as we hunted the other part of it. But the cycle was being disrupted. And the army and the management at that time, that didn't have too much of a clue, or really didn't have the people to police the area. And, part of its naiveness, I can forgive some of that, but some of it should be common sense that I would think that should be taught in school right off the bat. More than anything, how to treat others like they want to be treated. That should be something I think that should be. I don't know how you can teach that, except by maybe this kind of training and concept. Maybe it's more Eastern. I think it's a more Eastern kind of mental training. I don't know. Be sure, but I think that is part that needs to be taught when they're young. It'll help keep things from disrupting, just like how we were taught about firearms. Our guns, our weapons, keep them out of the way. Keep them, we don't let women step over our guns and things. We respect their things. We don't bother women's stuff. We respect their things. They respect our hunting thing. You respect the other person for, you don't point the gun towards another person. You keep your gun pointed up even when we're walking, because we could trip and the gun could go off. You could shoot somebody accidentally. You don't step in the way of guns. A gun is a tool, like a hammer and nails. It's not a toy. It's not like what you see on TV now where they got people pointing guns right off the bat. There isn't even a explanation. They shoot people for no reason. And kids think that's right. This is not right. This is the kind of discipline needs to be taught off the bat. If you don't teach it, you'll have chaos. They don't know what they're doing. It's not so much their fault. It's a game like they see on a computer TV. Oh, it's not real until it happens. Then, what are you going to do? You're going to put the bullet back in a gun? Once you squeeze the trigger, you've already made the decision. That realism, I don't think that they have they don't know what it is until it happens. And then the pure horror that they've taken another person's life set in, but then it's too late. Just like in the cartoons when we finally did get TV, me and my brother, Bugs Bunny, that was the kind of humor. And the baddest guy in the whole thing might be Wile E. Coyote or Bugs Bunny or sometimes, and then Elmer Fudd. He was a hunter, even him. He was out trying to get something to eat or whatever, but he sure didn't get much to eat in them cartoons. But this was a kind of, even then, the kind of respect of discipline, I think, that they need to slowly integrate back in. Because the tail end of all of this is those kids you see running around in the street doing all those things. And what they're showing on TV and our village kids seeing that straight up, straight off the bat, they're getting trained in their mind, not for the woods, not for respecting others. They're getting trained for the city. They go to the city and everybody else is on the same wavelength. They're thinking that kind of way, maybe even in your subconscious. This is what I see as a lot of the reason of breakdown of discipline. They don't respect because they don't know any better. Somebody's making money off of what's more exciting on television, or, you know, somebody should take this and use that, this knowledge that I've seen, maybe help change some of that. Because they're not being oriented for the woods. They're being oriented for the city. And that's why there's so many younger kids going into the city instead of staying in the bush. Because it takes time to train a hunter, to train a warrior, to train women to know what berries to eat, to know when to take an animal, how you respect him when you kill him. Your first kill, you drink some of the blood or eat a piece of the heart. This is part of our training, part of our respect to the land. You throw a piece of the fat in the fire for our people that had went before us. It's part of our hunting practice to respect the animal and our weapons and our life, to respect our life. And if these kids don't respect another's life because they just seen it was taken or thrown away, they don't value it. And that's what I see. It makes me very sad. It's what makes me keep going, to keep trying to pound this through in my own way. Also, so the young people can have a chance to have hope. Because if you don't have a choice, that's why I'm in such disagreement with the state of Alaska on many issues. When you don't have a choice anymore, you're a slave. This is not right. This is not what I see America is supposed to be in the first place. The natives are not going to saw the branch that they're standing on off if we have the time to train our kids how to take game, how much to take it, when to take it. We cannot teach them all this discipline and this knowledge on the weekend. If it can be integrated in the schools and perhaps help the non-natives also understand what we're doing, they wouldn't look at it as a threat because it's different. It's basic. It's common sense. It's respect. It's survival, and that's what it is, plain and simple. All the other stuff is just window dressing or frosting. You need a rock to stand on, to build on, to do anything on, and that's what the natives are. But it's deteriorating at a rapid pace, and this could be detrimental even to the non-native population. Everything is a circle. And it's going to swing around to the environment because they're not respecting their environment. Maybe not because it's because they don't know. That's the reason a lot of them are. And money. Money truly is the root of all evil. It makes a person do something that they normally would not do. There's other ways to make money, cleaner ways, the right way, to work the hard way for it. So when they do spend it, it won't be on some baloney. this is part of what I'm working towards as a whole. Part of that discipline that I was taught from my grandmother and grandparents and Grandma Allen and Chief Walter Northway, Stephen Northway, Andrew Isaac, his brother, Oscar Isaac, also Silas Solomon, Julius Paul, all kinds of different elders that would teach me things. And they choose certain people to carry certain knowledges because you have to be trusted with the knowledge. You can't just use it like a stick. They have to have that discipline and respect for it. If you give it to the wrong person, they could be hurting a bunch of innocent people with it, not understanding the sheer power of it. I was called to the bedside of many old people about to pass away, and they'll call for you hundreds of miles, and they got something to tell you before they die. I've been called to over 10 people, and the next day they would pass on. This is the kind of knowledge that I carry. And when I give it to certain people or certain pieces of it, I see that certain situation in a person, the one that would take care of it, that would not use it recklessly. Well, back to what I was saying, these old people, a lot of times that's what they're waiting for. And a young person has to earn this many times. You bringing them gifts of dry meat, things that they cannot do because their hands have arthritis and they're too old, or they can't do the things that they wanted to do. So you're their arms and legs. That's what we were taught. We cut wood for them. I do not understand. Nowadays I see the kids, they want to get money for everything they do. Well, if that's the case, I'm owed a couple $1 million because I've done a whole bunch of things. But it wasn't for the money that we got paid. And I'd like to I refer to my friend from Vinita in the Quechin country. He used to do a lot of the same. He was a chief of Vinita for 10 years, and me and him would confer on things like this. We'd work cutting wood, or we'd make dry meat, dry fish, or berries, or something for the old people. And what we'd get instead of money was they'd sit you down, you make tea and some biscuits or whatever they were cooking, and they'd sit you down and tell you a story, or they'd show you a trick about how to take apart bones, or how to prepare food in a certain way, or a trail that you didn't know was there, or they'd tell you about a secret little berry patch, or that only they knew about, or places where game trails were and where you could find abundance of moose or caribou. Many different things. Lots of times you'll be walking in the country and you'll find these places where there might be lots of fish in a shallow stream. You could just hook them out with a stick. Or you could get places where you could just narrow places where you could kill caribou just with a knife, because they squeeze between rocks. You could ambush them easy. All these kinds of things was our reward for doing this work for the old people. And that's what these kids have got to realize, is by keeping their old people healthy, warm, and cared for means that they care about who we are, They take pride in who we are. Because it wasn't easy to get where they are. There's so much of a hard life, like I said, from 500 years to right today in jet planes flying around, guys walking on the moon. That is unbelievable shock. It has to be unproportionate. It's like you jumped into a time machine and you stepped off right in the middle of New York City. That's the kind of feeling that the old people, I'm sure, that's the kind of knowledge they had to cram into their mind overnight. Now, it takes a special kind of person to be able to adapt to that. And the non-natives, they should understand this kind of shock and have a little bit of patience as well. This part I could understand about the lashing out, some of the young people, and a lot of the drinking too can relate back to some of that. They do not understand a lot of what is going on. This bridge, some of it has to be bridged or slowly understood. This is part of what I'm talking about. Perhaps this can help with that, because I have stepped away, even outside of myself, to take a look from a distance. What would I do if I was in this position? How to realize. I spend much time alone so I can find these answers. Our old people had people like that to go in to find answers. Another thing I'd like to touch on is the mind, these dreams that people pass on that have a touch, what they call a touch, or juzi. Our people are in the dark for 9 months of the year. Sometimes you are sitting in one place for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then cold. You have not very much to do, so you explore your mind. The mind is a vast place where the non-natives have went into reading and writing. Our people explored in dreams. There's nothing that cannot be done. Opening of doors. You have built four walls to make yourself feel safe, because you can trust that. That box has been constructed. Our people have learned, a lot of them, these kind of people, can step through the box, because the box doesn't exist. Only in your mind. This is part of our teaching. This is the unique kind of people that you have, and need to appreciate them and learn by them, and not to take, but also give to help integrate in a good way, not to erase us, to understand that we are different in many ways, and we wish to help. We also wish to be understood, and we wish our way to be preserved in a way that to take care of nature. It is our home. It is who we are. These stories, these things, that's who we are. And then, just like Mia, I'm 33 now. When I was young, I built my way up through the ranks of the clan, the hard way, till I became a war chief with so many under me. This is not going to be shouted out in the streets of Fairbanks or down to the trooper station, because many things the warriors and things have to do are for the tribe, for your nation, for your people. These things you only read about in the paper. These things aren't understood. Somebody would not tell you easily of these things. you graduate to there, and once you become at that position, then you go to the chief's position. Now I'm a chief, and I have referred the war chief to a younger one, quicker. I cannot let, what do you call it, my ego, or I'm getting slower. I cannot go as far as I once did when I was in my 20s, mid-20s. I'm not as quick. I have more responsibilities, children, family. And the war chief must not have these weaknesses. It would be looked at in weakness in war. So you would have to worry about it. The warriors have to protect the tribe. Have to protect our way, and those who threaten the way, they will be fought for by these people, and our tribe will know who these people are. A lot of times they'll show up and disappear. They move all the time. They spend very much time alone, disciplining. Each warrior or war chief may have anywhere from 4 to 20 under him. It has been this way for 1,000 years. This is what is going on, even though they think it, they do not understand it. We are fighting for our rights, our way, so to speak. The very first potlatch that we had here about 4 years ago, where I took 2 moose out of season for a memorial potlatch for Grandma Ellen Demet and her mom and dad and her children. She buried, her and her husband had to bury over at the old village. Very painful, hard time for her. And her daughter, 2 daughters, made that potlatch for their sisters. This was very hard on them. We shot those 2 moose, and the local fish and game officer heard about it, and he went and he gave me 2 citations for killing them out of season. And at that time, there was no law for memorial potlatches. There is for a potlatch when somebody passes away, but not for memorial potlatch services. And this is what I done it for, part of our belief. And so we had to go through the courts. We made it all the way up to the state court. Then we were going to refer it over into the federal court where, well, the governor, Tony Knowles, seeing that the state would have lost in this battle. Because in federal court under ANALCA, we are supposed to be granted this right. So he pardoned me of 2 counts of killing these moose. And to this date, I think I'm the only one that has ever been pardoned of this crime, which consists of 10 days in jail, which would cost a taxpayer $96 a day to support every person there. And when we kill something out of season, it'll equal out just about the same. Whether the moose we kill is going to equal out about the same amount of paperwork and time, and if you putting that person in jail and having to feed and clothe them. Also, what they have not understood is you've made him a felon, which is just about the crime of grand theft or murder. That's just for killing something to eat. This is wrong. Now he cannot get a job like you and me, even in his own native corporation. He cannot get a job to support his family. He's a criminal now. This is happening in the Upper Tana more than any other place because we don't have salmon. Salmon, the people of Lower Yukon, Lower Copper, have got this right. We don't have salmon. It's because God made us in the high country, and the salmon only come right below Healy Lake and turn around, and They're not worth eating by the time they get there anyway. We are big game hunters. That's what we're trained for. That's what we are. We hunt to survive. And if they make us a felon, then every man above the age of 12 in the Upper Tanana, from when he kills his first moose, which is a sacred act, is a criminal. This must be changed. We are being genocided for this. It's common sense. What's going on here? You have to turn us into Robin Hood. The same thing the king for killing his deer in the forest is punishable by death. You basically have taken a working man off the street now. He can't get a regular job. The state is going to have to pay for his children. AFDC, blah, 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 on and on. And the 10 days in jail. This is shooting themselves in the foot. They should have the smarts enough to change, to figure it out. My reason saying this is the law had been changed directly because of the pardon on the two moose I shot. Legislation was passed through the state law to make it legal for Memorial Potlatch moose to be taken. The same thing needs to happen with the situation in the Upper Tanana for subsistence. When they put anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000, which has been, I seen it on TV, I called in about it. The big game sportsmen sponsor this for poaching. In the Upper Tanana, it's used in the wrong way. There's not a lot of cash flowing around up there, and some small inner feuds have sparked into a bigger situation because the temptation of turning someone in. Some people just cannot resist this temptation. It should not be. It's a bounty. They put a bounty on our hunters. This is wrong. The bounty, I thought, was they abolished it from wolves and put it on the people. This makes no sense. This is what I work towards changing. And I'll do everything I can to change it before I'm gone. And if I'm gone before that's changed, I would like this to go on record as don't give up. The young people, do not give up, because you don't know. That is the whole reason on climbing a mountain, or going to find out. You will know. Even when somebody tells you in a story, the story will change with you going out into the woods and making another story. Because it's never, every hunt is different. So don't give up. Believe in who you are, and don't let it go down. There's so much knowledge and goodness to be upheld. Our songs and dances. Don't be afraid to get out there and speak. It's like taking a step. It's like what I said. There's no four walls. So there's limitless situations that you can do. Do not give that up. Don't be tempted by a dark side, which is the easy way to sell. Don't be tempted. Somebody sits there and paints you this great, easy picture. Well, when your heart's clogged up with fat because you had too easy of a situation, or and you ain't going to live that long is what it is. You got it hard and you exercise every day like Grandma Allen and Aunt Agnes. We go for a walk. Or my friend Connie Fran does that every day. My friend here sitting beside me probably does that every day because they figured it out. They ain't stupid. And All you ain't stupid neither. Please make the choice to continue. And don't throw away these old ways, because they're not old. It's a circle, and you're in it. Thank you.
This is Don Calloway. It's August 17th, Thursday, continuing the oral history with Pat Saylor.
Okay. I just wanted to briefly touch back on where I left off just for a few minutes. There was something that was weighing on me as the first kill for a young hunter, but usually that would be between the ages of 12 and 14. They go out and they get their first moose. Usually there's a small potlatch, 20 to 50 blankets or so, made where they give it to their opposite clan, or they can either do it that way, or their whole moose, the one they get, they give it away to the whole village or into elders and to others who are needy. And this teaches them self-worth and to and becoming a man, because that's when they're going through puberty as well. But it gives it gives them their place where they start. That's another law that I'd like to get changed maybe before my time's done. But it's hard for them to go out and compete when there's only a 10-day season and you have an unexperienced young hunter that has to compete with the rest of the hunters in a 10-day season with no with no experience. His chances of getting a moose and well, becoming a man are greatly hindered, I'd say. He's that's the reason it would be nice if he could take it when he was ready, and the moose would definitely go and be well taken care of and go to the people who need it, and so that he can become a man and a warrior and a hunter and begin his status in the tribe. If he never gets to hunt and never gets to do these things, or he's a criminal for doing these things, he's taught it's right in one way and wrong in the other, it greatly excludes him even from his own village and his own people, because he needs to have status. He needs to grow, to climb, to see it. It teaches him to be a provider for his family, so that if when he gets one, that he knows what he's doing. So that's where I'd like to close on that stuff. I'd like to talk about the trapping industry. From what I heard from some old people, Silas Solomon, my father, who's done a lot of research, they tried to make a fur and big game reserve of the whole Upper Tana from the Big Gersel into Canada. There was around three different meetings where they signed some papers. I heard John Hajdukovic was instrumental in doing this, but all that they were given was the Tetlin Reserve. And the government tried to get all the natives in Upper Tana moved on to this reservation. Well, this wasn't going to work, because like here in Healy Lake, you would be giving up some of the most prime marten country in the entire state, most likely. Even the families we have here, four or five families, each family has got anywhere from 75 to 100 miles of trap line up into the high country, where they alternate trap lines like you do farming. You would trap one area one year, and then the next year you would trap the other area, and you would rotate them like you rotate fields. Also, in the older days here in Healy Lake, we Chief Healy and his sons had mink farms and fox farms where they built cages and they made them on the side of mountain, the streams that never froze, hot springs, so that the fresh water was running through the cages and they didn't have to worry about watering the animal. And they had big fish traps for whitefish, which they dam off most of the stream, and they would take as much whitefish as they need to feed their dog teams for their trap lines and their freight business, which they had freight that came from Delta and Fairbanks and went all the way up the river. They would feed their fox and mink, which they would breed them to get the ones the biggest and maybe the darkest or the lightest, whatever was going on with the trade of the garment industry and so on. The federal government outlawed the fish trap, and also the big game snare, also the caribou fences. And the fact of the matter is, they only took the fat ones a lot of times there when they were catching them in those corrals, and they would let the leaders go so that the caribou wouldn't get confused and would come back the same place the next year and so on. They'd take the fat ones, what they needed. Same with the fish. If you caught grayling or pike or suckers, you could always let them go because when they went in the fish trap, they were alive. So you would take out fish like that and take only the white fish and what you needed. And the white fish provided cooking oil, which they boiled the stomachs down and the inside fat. And they would store this oil in permafrost holes. And they would dig into the ice and have containers which they'd put this oil in, cook with all winter. And there was with the caribou, they'd also, all the bones that they couldn't pack or use were tied in trees, anywhere from 10 to 15 foot above the ground. Big bundles of them. And the marrow inside would be preserved for years and years. And during hard times, they would climb up into these trees and take these down and bust them open for the marrow and the nutrients. And trapping is how I made a living up till about 5 years ago, where the prices went down, so where it's almost not feasible to trap now. The people who were trying to put bans on the fur should understand that we're not going to cut off the leg we're standing. We alternate our trap lines. We have to take care of our fur, so it takes care of us. If we trap out the ground, we simply be cutting our own throats. And freezing is not, when the animal freezes, it doesn't suffer as much as they think, because it goes into shock. It doesn't feel anything. If anybody's ever almost froze to death, I have a couple of times. And if there was a way to go, that wouldn't be so bad. There's a lot worse ways. But it helps sustain the bush, and taught a lot of younger people hard work. And when you take away that industry, you're simply putting more pressure on the jobs in the cities. So by taking away one thing, they're putting more pressure on the jobs in the city. They're making it, if they make it hard on us, then they have no choice but to move to town and put pressure on their jobs, their resources in town. They need to think of this in a different way. But the fur industry is very crucial to the bush villages, like muskrat trapping in the upper Tanana. That food, half-dried muskrats, it is very treasured. It's good food. It's almost worth more than the skin right now. it's something that they really like, and they take good care of it. And there's a lot of different trapping techniques you can learn from different people. Gene Henry's a renowned lynx trapper. Robert Frank from Vinitai. These men have caught hundreds of lynx in a season. You have Paul Kerstatter here that lives at Healy Lake is a renowned wolf trapper, and Danny Vanguard. You have Martin trappers. Gideon James and Arctic Village, they go out and they'll catch 300 marten in a season, you know. These are the people we've learned from. The different trappers got different talent for different animals. They know that animal inside and out, front to back. Like lynx, they're very neat animal. They're clean. They don't like to break trail. They're lazy. They walk on rabbit trails. They have competition there. Just like this story about lynx. The whole family, when they're growing up, there might be five or six. They even have a competition. Some are old people seen. Now the snow bends over bushes and there's a little circle in the middle of it. They see who can go through that circle without knocking the snow down. And whoever knocks it down in the snow, that's the loser, I guess. But different animals, different people they know things about those animals. Like Paul Kerstad, he knows wolves. He was a wolf trapper for their bounty, and he holds the record in the state for the most wolves. His talent trapping wolves is unsurpassed. These kind of things is where you take a little bit of each what you've learned, and you learn it out in the bushes. It's like wolverine trapping. I became good at that because that's the only thing that's worth any money anymore. You know, I got real good at it, you know. And that's my specialty, wolverine and marten. Old story goes, wolverine is everybody's brother-in-law because he has feet like a bear, and he's related between the bear family and the weasel family. So that makes him everybody's brother-in-law. So that's the story behind the wolverine. Chief Healy, that's his Indian name, is Naltzin, which is wolverine. And that's us. We're small and very vicious when we're backed in the corner. That's who we are. Thank you very much. Hope this does well. I'm here to tell about a story we seen my grandma and them when they were down at the old village. They looked straight out past the mouth of the Healy River there and toward the edge of the tree line, and I seen a caribou running across the lake with something hanging on his neck. It flopped down once in a while and flop around and take off. So they hooked up their dog team because they didn't know what that was. And they went all the way to Hedden Lake where Grandma described. And it was a wolverine hanging off of the caribou's neck, and he had it down. And that's how vigorous a wolverine is. Okay, that's something to touch on that story.